WMNFGames.com.
And you are listening to WMNF Tampa's Sarasota Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. Hi, I'm Mary Glennie.
And I'm Arlene Englehart. And you are listening to From a Woman's Point of View. We hope you'll stay with us for the next hour. Not a surprise, but we will be dealing with what's coming up next Tuesday, our election. And it is so important, as former President Obama said, it is the most important election of our lives. The most important thing is vote. You vote, get your friends and neighbors and relatives to vote, and even call your friends and relatives in other states and encourage them to vote. There's good information on the From a Woman's Point of View, or on the League of Women Voters website. You can go to the one for your state, whatever state you might be in. And also, there's good information in many of the newspapers. So check it out, get informed, and vote. And the British are coming. So we have a concert coming up. You're going to want to check that out, too.
Well, these are really momentous times, and I do hope you keep attuned to WMNF all the time. Particularly, I'm hoping you were just listening to Amy Goodman, and I think it was Alan Nirin, and I think it's really very, very chilling. Slow march, and now it's kind of going to be a crescendo to fascism in this country. And it is happening on our watch, right under our noses. And so, as former President Obama and so many have said, this election is huge. Is this the path you want for this country? It is really, really chilling. The violence we've had in the last couple of weeks, wow. what can I say? It's called, the professionals have a term for it now, stochastic terrorism. Terrorism is kind of almost like epidemiologists use this all the time, that you can't predict specifics, but you certainly can predict events. And we are living in a time of stochastic violence. And I was able to talk to Dr. Maha Hilal yesterday, and she talks about what's in a word? What's in terrorists? And how is it replying right now to violence in the time of Trump? And really, really chilling stuff. But Arlene is right. First, we're going to be reviewing particularly the amendments, Amendment 11, because some of you got in touch with us last week and you told us you were confused about it. And so I recontacted Patricia Brigham of Florida League of Women Voters, and she is going to try and clarify it for us. And then I was also able to catch up with Ann Swerlick, and she is a health policy advisor with Florida Policy Institute. Another huge reason you've got tremendous choices in this election, and you've got records of people in their prior service that you can get some idea of what they have in mind for Florida for health care. And Ann Swerlick will give you just a brief overview of some of the needs of Florida health care, and I must admit, I was aware that our health services, frankly, are so utterly woeful and not serving the needs of these people at all. You kind of look, if you remember back at the horrible Parkland slayings in the school of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas School, and that student actually asked for help, and there was no help available because Florida ranks dismally in the number of counselors and school health officials, psychologists, etc., available to the students, and one of the many areas that we are paying dearly in every way in this state. So, without further ado, well, first I want to play this promo, and then we will get into the heart of the show.
Hi, this is Larnell Scott with a WMNF community announcement. Superheroes are fun to watch at the movies. However, there are almost 1,000 abused and neglected children in Pasco and Pinellas counties waiting for real-life superheroes to volunteer as guardians ad litem and become their voices. These precious children need volunteers to help them find safe, permanent homes. Guardian ad litem volunteers become superheroes to our community's children. You may learn more at herotoachild.org.
Indeed, she's quite right. So many children in this state need help, and also the disabled, the elderly. And I remember this state is kind of, it's one of the fastest growing states, and actually a sizable segment of our population is with the elderly and disabled. So we have very serious challenges, and this election you can make a real impact. But anyway, as I said, I'm going to put this first interview with Patricia Brigham, and she is the president of the Florida League of Women Voters. And so she's going to try and clarify some aspects of Amendment 11. Give a listen here. President of the Florida League of Women Voters. And last week, we played on the air the marvelous summary she gave of all the amendments. And we had quite a few questions, and people were confused and didn't know about Amendment 11. And so if we could go back, Patricia, to Amendment 11, and I'm not quite sure whether it's the aspect, particularly about the criminality, if they change, the legislature change. And also, I think maybe part of it also is the wording of high-speed rail. So could we go through Amendment 11?
Absolutely. This is an amendment that has come out of the Constitution Revision Commission. It is, once again, one of those bundled amendments. This one has three parts. The first part, is that the Florida Constitution currently has a clause allowing the state legislature to pass laws restricting the property rights of, quote, aliens ineligible for citizenship, unquote. Okay, so what does that mean? It means that the legislature has the authority to prevent non-citizens from owning, inheriting, buying, or selling property. Now, these restrictions really were very popular in the nation in the early 20th century, and that was largely out of fear, of course, because, you know, of the Japanese and World War II. Florida's land ownership amendment was approved by voters in 1926, but the state currently has no laws on the books restricting the property rights of non-citizens. Then in 2008, Florida voters rejected an amendment that would have done away with the ownership restrictions, and that was partly because of confusion over its meanings and anti-immigrant sentiment. So Amendment 11 is a second attempt to repeal these property right restrictions. So that's the first part of Amendment 11. The second part of this amendment would affect criminal defendants. So let me give you an example. Currently, if someone is arrested for a crime, they'll be prosecuted under the statute that's in effect when the alleged crime was committed. Say a person is arrested on November 30th for a drug crime. So even if a new law took effect the next day that reduced the sentence of that drug crime, the defendant would be subject to the stricter sentence under the old law. So this amendment, this part of Amendment 11, would ensure that criminal defendants are prosecuted under the most current laws on the books. However, this question does not alter the Constitution's mandate that if a law is repealed altogether, someone who was arrested before that repeal could still face prosecution for the crime. But the clincher here is that if someone is arrested for a drug crime and the next day a law takes effect that reduces the sentences for that crime, the defendant would still be subject to the stricter sentence under the old law. And then the third part of Amendment 11 deletes language about high-speed transportation. In 2000, Floridians approved an amendment that mandated building some type of high-speed ground transportation. And then 4 years later, voters overturned that amendment, but the language about high-speed transportation was not removed from the Constitution, and this amendment would take out that obsolete language.
Well, those are three pretty disparate aspects. One of the real problems I have with the commissions bundling this together. But if I could go back, I think it's kind of funny because we were hearing, you know, so many of these laws about owning property, as you have said, came from immigration and fear of immigrants acquiring property. Yet I'm thinking of all of these huge real estate and deals done by many, shall we say, people that are laundering some money that they have to do with an awful lot of properties down right here in Florida. And it seems kind of disingenuous because some people obviously have been ignoring that law for a long time. And so, but also then, and I would imagine actually with the changing attitudes, particularly to possession of, say, marijuana, et cetera, and what makes you a seller or a user, et cetera, that this really could have a lot of implications for a lot of people, don't you think?
Absolutely. You know, if someone's in jail because they were caught with marijuana and then the sentencing is changed the next day after they committed the crime, they would still be punished by the previous sentence.
And tell me, the League of Women Voters, if I looked on your website correctly, has not taken a position on this amendment. Why was that? What was your thinking?
That's correct. We did not take a position because we believe the bundling of this amendment was so incredibly confusing that also, why are they, you know, taking out some obsolete language and leaving in other obsolete language? That made no sense, and we just felt that because of that particular piece of the amendment, we could not take a position.
Okay, and then real quickly with the amendments, let's review the amendments that the League is supporting and also your strong feelings on some they need to reject. Let's real quickly review that.
Absolutely. We strongly support a citizens initiative that the League worked very hard along with some coalition partners to get on the ballot, and that is Amendment 4, which would restore the eligibility to vote to persons with felony convictions who have completed their sentences. It would exclude those who have committed murder or felony sex crimes, but all others, as long as they paid their full dues to society, including, you know, their parole, probation, whatever, they would receive their voting rights back.
And then also, as I understand it, you approve Amendment 9.
Yes, Amendment 9 is one of those bundled amendments, and this one has created a bit of humor into this process because it prohibits oil drilling beneath waters controlled by Florida. However, it also would prohibit the use of e-cigarettes, which is also known as vaping, in indoor workplaces. So that's created quite a bit of laughter at some of the amendment presentations we've given, because you could ask, well, what does oil drilling have to do with vaping? The CRC could, I would ask them that question, but we support this amendment based on the ban on offshore drilling, which we are clearly in support of. We want our environment protected.
Yeah, and particularly with the threats of Trump's already saying how he wanted to change for the continental shelf, like 90% of our continental shelf could be open. That's pretty serious. And so then moving on, you also voted yes on number 3 and 13, right?
Yes, number 3 would restrict casino gambling, and it would allow Florida voters to make the decisions regarding any increases in casino gambling, and that is consistent with our position against gambling.
And you took no position on Amendment 11, which we just discussed, and also Amendment 12, but a very strong no, and one I just wanted to talk about just a little bit because I think it's so huge, Amendment 5 and a two-thirds majority.
Yes, we strongly oppose Amendment 5. It does not include a provision that would allow for tax increases in times of emergency, such as a hurricane, a flood, or a recession. And it really is an abrogation of the legislature's fiduciary responsibility to pass a reasonable budget.
Yeah, and I'll be talking later with some of the health measures in the state and how something like that passed could just about freeze everything in its tracks. So really important amendments, and it's no on all the rest, too, I understand, your organization. And so real quickly, because I know you cover all aspects of voter, you know, it matters. And obviously we can't do registration now, that's long past. But what are the important things for people to do to make sure their voter registration, everything is correct, and what do they need to take to their voting place?
They need to take their driver's license or a state-approved photo ID. They need to make sure that, you know, their address is correct, as their address matches the one on file at the Supervisor of Elections office. If they're mailing in their ballot, they need to make sure they sign the ballot. That's a common mistake that we've seen, why ballots are being rejected in some counties, especially young people who are new to the voting process. They need to make sure they sign those ballots before they send them in and that their signature matches what is on file at the Supervisor of Elections office. I also encourage all of your listeners who are young people to take advantage of early voting on the University of South Florida campus and other campuses around the state. You know, the league sued the Secretary of State, along with the Andrew Goodman Foundation, who was on our lawsuit, along with several students from the University of Florida and a student from Florida State University. We sued to overturn the prohibition on early voting on college and university campuses, and we won. And so now we have the major universities in Florida and some colleges, providing early voting sites on campus. So there is no reason whatsoever for students who are eligible to vote to make it a plan to stop by their campus voting place and vote, because we've seen numbers coming in that young people are not voting and the numbers that we have been hoping, and that needs to change. We need our young people to exercise their constitutional right. They need to start doing it now so it can become a lifelong habit.
Yeah, and I voted the other day, and I didn't have a wait, but it was the fullest, it was the busiest I have ever seen it, because I always early vote. And so it'd be a real good idea, if you possibly can, to vote early, just to avoid, you know, some lines. And so, and again, yeah, with the young people, so important that they vote and that everybody vote. And so, Patricia Brigham, I have called upon your organization quite a bit, but I really appreciate all the work you've done and all the efforts you're making to help people know and to how to vote. And so any other area that you want to really mention before I let you go?
Absolutely. For all questions about the amendments, we have them laid out on our website, lwvfl.org. You can read the summaries, what they would do if they pass, what they would not do, who supports, who opposes. Also, for all things voting, go to beReadyToVote.org, and our online voter guide is vote411.org. And so we want to make sure that our voters are informed, because the more informed the voter, the more responsible the vote.
Well, Patricia Brigham, president of the Florida League of Women Voters, I really want to thank you so much for all the work you're doing, your group is doing, and giving us this time today. I know how busy you are. Thanks an awful lot.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
And again, you know, if you're confused about the amendments, there are several organizations that have, you know, their recommendations. And so do make take available all the places you can to find all the information you need. And again, you're listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater, Community Conscious Radio, and this is From a Woman's Point of View. And so just a little diversion from all this stuff on politics. Let's play this little promo.
The British are coming! The British are coming again!
The 60s had ended, but England's audio assault on the States continued in the late 70s as progressive rock gave way to metal and new wave began to assert itself. WMNF presents The British Are Coming. 16 bands perform the best songs by the best British bands, 1975 to 1979. Saturday, November 3rd. Music starts at 6 at Skipper's Smokehouse. Tickets $12 advance. Go to WMNF.org for more info.
Oh, that sounds like really something you don't want to miss. And so, again, just coming up this Saturday. Oh, Okay, well, you know, I do hope you heard Amy Goodman's show and talking about the kind of the now not so slow and behind the scenes aspects of fascism. And so I was able to catch up with Dr. Maha Halal yesterday, and I think you're going to find her very, very interesting. So let's give a listen to Dr. Halal.
Okay. I am so happy to welcome to the show Dr. Halal, and she is co-director of Justice for Muslims, and she's an organizer with Witness Against Torture and a council member of School of America's Watch. Dr. Halal has worked extensively in anti-torture field and is co-principal investigator with the Torture Treatment Initiative out of Tulane University Traumatology Institute. So Dr. Halal, who has written a very fine article on rewire.news, what's in a word? Responses to violence in the Trump era. So welcome so much to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Mary.
Well, I'm really excited to have you, not just in light of what's been happening just in the last 2 weeks, but I particularly am very interested in your work with torture and the Traumatology Institute, because I guess I'm looking right now and I'm thinking back to the Bush administration and, so to speak, the efforts to legalize torture, and now looking at some of the proponents and some of the individuals who work behind the scenes, namely Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, now both sitting in the Supreme Court. It would seem to me that America has never dealt with its efforts to bring torture up into the acceptable light.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important, you know, to be asking these questions again, particularly because, as you said, the issue of torture has never been resolved. And, you know, I think people more or less assumed that under the Obama administration, torture had ended, and that simply wasn't the case. And as with all the administrations post 9/11, really what you see happening is that what one administration did basically set the framework for what another administration was building off of. And so when we talk about torture being banned or whether it's acceptable or not, it's important to look at, you know, what actually happened under Obama, which is that torture did continue, maybe to a lesser extent. But to kind of view that as more benign or some sort of positive change is very problematic, right? Because theoretically, we should be condemning torture in all its forms. And this should just be a part of normal American law. Like, this should not be a debatable issue as to whether or not torture is condoned in this country for any reason whatsoever.
Well, and it brings us right up to the present time and just the extraordinary violence in the last 2 weeks, although actually it's just a little bit more obvious. But starting, you know, with the pipe bombs that were sent, and thank heavens none of them went off, to so many people who President Trump has mentioned many times as enemies of the state and various kinds. And then we go right into the individual in that, I can't remember, Mississippi or wherever, that shot the two black men working in the store because he couldn't get into church. And then we go to the synagogue where, unfortunately, with assault rifle, he killed 11 people. And, you know, that we're looking at just this absolute spate of violence. But I think in your article, you very, very justifiably point out that with obviously these acts of terrorism, you know, because they were all meant to really impact all of us, Trump does not refer to them as terrorists.
Right. And I mean, this is pretty characteristic, especially post 9/11, that you see a differential labeling of acts of violence. So, of course, if it's a Muslim perpetrating an act of violence, it's considered an act of terrorism. And there's this assumption that, you know, they're not a lone wolf, so they must be working with some overseas network. And, of course, when it's not a Muslim, it's labeled as something different. For example, in this case, he referred to the bombs being sent to political officials or former political officials as acts of political violence or terroristic events. So this is a very different way of looking at the construction of terrorism based on who the perpetrator is. And I should say with that, you know, at this point, it's pretty much beating the dead horse, as I said in the article, about why we don't call acts of violence by non-Muslims terrorism. We already know why what the reason is for that, because there's a specific social construction of Muslims that benefits the state to call only their acts of violence terroristic. And when you do that, and when you call Muslims terrorists, it enables certain measures to repress the Muslim community, whether you're talking about domestically or abroad.
Yeah, and I think it's troubling, and I believe his name was Robert Bowers, that killed, assassinated so many in the Tree of Life synagogue. And he not only was anti-Semitic, but his reasons for acting is that he thought that there were Muslim terrorists in the people coming up from Honduras, and that the Halal Foundation was encouraging these people to come into the United States, and he saw it as an invasion. And to me, that's very troubling thinking, that to just dismiss this, because to me, that is terrorism covering an awful lot of fronts there.
Right. You know, it's very convenient to think about what happened, whether you're talking about the synagogue or the two black individuals who were shot, as, you know, some sort of interpersonal act of violence, as opposed to violence that's specifically being condoned by the state, because the state is modeling the mistreatment of these groups and sending a signal to society that it is okay to abuse various marginalized groups and various groups in society that are deemed unworthy. So this is a very particular problem in terms of how we look at what happens on the ground amongst society and what's happening at the state level, and really understanding the connection, which politicians are obviously hesitant to even talk about, because then that would put the blame squarely on themselves, and that's not something they want to deal with. But, you know, the fact that we've seen a rise in hate crimes, for example, under Trump is no coincidence, because of the rhetoric that he's continued to use, demonizing various groups. And with the synagogue shooting in particular, I'm glad you brought up the fact that the shooter was particularly upset about Jewish groups assisting Middle Easterners or Arabs / Muslims into coming into the United States. And that stems directly from Trump's comments that there are Middle Easterners as part of this caravan. And the interesting thing in what he said is he didn't even say they're terrorists. He just said they were Middle Easterners. And that apparently was sufficient to indicate that, in fact, he's talking about terrorists, right? He was using Middle Eastern as a stand-in for terrorists. And that's very problematic. And the other thing I want to mention about that is it's very problematic that that sort of got swept under the rug. And I had written another article about that as well, fully looking at how normalized Islamophobia is, such that he can make these kind of comments, and not only does it not raise any eyebrows in society generally, but it wasn't really part of the larger discourse around the caravan as to, you know, the fact that we're being demonized as sort of a casualty of Trump's speech.
And again, we're talking to Dr. Halal, and I'm very impressed with her work, particularly saying torture, and at Tulane, where, you know, she's involved, principal investigator with torture treatment, and the Traumatology Institute. Now, it would seem to me, you know, because actually, I don't know why Americans kind of want to deny, or they don't like to think about just how violent really our country has been. And when Trump, and in your article you said very well that to speak of political violence, I mean, essentially this is a country that pretty much eradicated Native Americans to take over this land, and then denied them citizenship. In fact, we're looking right now in some states, the efforts to deny them the right to vote because they have a different type of postal system, you know, with their living, you know, but they're trying to take away their right to vote right now. And then we had to fight a vicious civil war, which actually pretty much was lost in many ways of Reconstruction. And we went through all of that terrible period. And then with the civil rights, and now we come up to now. And yet with torture, and I would imagine, being you have studied it so much, that the person perpetrating the torture has to think they come from a vastly superior moral ethic, that the ends justifies what they're doing, because these are lesser individuals. And it would seem to me that they really need to have this sense of a lesser individual, that you can do these kind of things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think torture is predicated on the notion that, you know, the person who is being tortured is not human. And, you know, when it comes to Muslims in particular, which is the community that I focus on, the ways in which the narrative has been constructed to dehumanize Muslims, to ignore the consequences of the post 9/11 national security policies, and to kind of consider torture okay, not just at the state level, but you know, societally, it's considered relatively acceptable to, you know, torture Muslims. And you know, part of the equation here is also that not only are Muslims dehumanized, but when it comes to the state, the rhetoric that's used, whether you're talking about Bush, Obama, or Trump, is that state violence is inherently benevolent. And when you have inherently benevolent state violence, then you what ends up happening is that, you know, you're positioning the people who you're torturing or who you're inflicting this violence as so inferior that it's okay to repress them, it's okay to torture them, it's okay to detain them, it's okay to murder them. Because, again, the state violence is benevolent, right? We're doing it for a just cause. And I think that's something that's been very prominent in the narrative, right? And I remember a quote from Bush in 2006 where he essentially said, you know, there's no comparison between us and the terrorists. It's reprehensible to even think we're on the same level. And so I'm not sure on what planet state violence by the United States is less reprehensible than any act of state violence by terrorists, for example, right? I mean, you're talking about the utilization of things like drones, which literally blow people up. So this constant injection into the narrative, again, of this benevolent state violence, not only serves the purpose of justifying the violence, but also helps to further dehumanize the communities and groups that you want to inflict the violence on.
Yeah, and again, I'm looking at right now that total chaos and the terrible dilemmas in defining who we are as a country right now. When you have, as you say, the benevolent country, the nation, but as your enemy, so to speak, it's not a nation, it's not even a group, it's a terrorist, an individual, so to speak. It would seem to me, or you can put a whole religion, that it would seem to me that I cannot think of a greater threat to democracy, because if you have such a benevolent state, and your enemy is a terrorist, to me, inevitably, everyone can be defined as a terrorist.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the fundamental thing is, you know, when you can look at terrorism, I mean, I personally know of no cases whatsoever, and perhaps, you know, this is something I need to do more research on, but where terrorism emerged out of something other than state violence. So to me, when you're talking about terrorism, in order to determine how people would actually behave in the absence of state violence, you have to extricate the state violence from the equation. And what happens in the United States is that we're only fed one part of the narrative or one side of the equation, which is that these people are inherently violent and angry, and that our actions as a country has no impact whatsoever on the response from the people that are committing these acts of terrorism. So I think it's also really important to push the narrative so that we're not constantly seeing things in a vacuum and ignoring specifically the role of state violence in, you know, allowing some of these groups to thrive. And a lot of these groups, you know, there's always talk about, you know, for example, with countering violent extremism, about countering the narrative. And the narrative they're talking about countering is oftentimes when these terrorist groups are saying, look what the U.S. is doing, they're bombing our countries, et cetera, et cetera. And the thing is, that is what the U.S. is doing. And so the counter-narrative is not about, it shouldn't be about minimizing that, because that's the truth of what's happening. It should be about how do we end U.S. state violence, U.S. intervention in all of these countries that's allowing for the provocation of these groups.
And it's no wonder that a free media and honest press is such a threat to some individuals in this country.
Right. It's absolutely a threat. And I think you see that. I mean, under the Trump administration, you know, I think there's a sense of heroism on the part of some of the news media, right? Because they're specifically challenging Trump. But the thing is, the reason why Trump has been allowed to thrive in this way is because of the ways the media participated and colluded with the state in earlier administrations. So, you know, it's very interesting because CNN often, you know, is one of the news stations that's, you know, minimized by Trump or insulted by Trump. But CNN has upheld very problematic narratives around state violence in past administrations. So, you know, I think as per the usual, when I do my analysis, I always look at things from a systemic level. And so whether you're talking about the media, whether you're talking about state policy, that has to be how you view sort of the trajectory and why we're in the position that we're in today.
Well, you do it so well, and I really enjoyed your article in Rewire.news, and I hope to read a lot more of your articles because I am fascinated with your work. I think you have so much to contribute, and in just the interest of time, I had to go through this pretty quickly. Is there anything you wanted to say that we didn't cover?
So I think the one thing I wanted to highlight was the question about whether or not we should use the word terrorism. And as I mentioned in the article, you know, many people think of terrorism as a pretty meaningless word at this point because of the way it's differentially applied. And I think that that's a valid criticism. But I also, again, as I said in the article, I'm not sure that changing the word would actually change the way that Muslims are constructed. They're still going to, so if you decide to call it political violence, it's still going to be applied to Muslims differentially because of the way that the narrative positions Muslim violence as exceptional and somehow more violent, barbaric, and dangerous than other forms of violence. So to me, there's a deeper problem that we need to address, which is how Muslim violence is constructed. And only in doing that and challenging that will a difference in the wording, I think, actually have some impact.
Well, Dr. Hilal, I really want to thank you for giving us this time today. I know how busy you are, and I hope to talk to you in the future because I think you have a lot to contribute. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Mary.
And again, you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater Community Conscious Radio, and that was Dr. Hilal. And just a term I think that we need to keep in mind. Again, stochastic terrorism, mass communications, including social media, inspire random acts of terrorism, statistically predictable, but individually unpredictable. We're in the era of creeping fascism, people, whether we want to believe it or not. And I'm sorry we're packing so much in, but these are very momentous times, and there are so many things that you need to be aware of and to get yourself collected so you can vote and make your vote so meaningful. And so I was able to catch up with Ann Swerlich, and we gave just a brief overview of some of the health situations in this state. So Ann Swerlich.
I am so happy to welcome to the show Ann Swerlich, and she is one of the health policy directors at the Florida Policy Institute, and we're going to be actually reviewing a very, very important subject now with the elections coming up next week, healthcare in this state. So, Ann Swerlich, welcome so much to the show.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Well, first, before I get into it, even though I've had some other guests, tell me something about the Florida Policy Institute.
Well, we're an independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting widespread prosperity for all Floridians, and we focus a lot on the state budget and state policies impacted by the budget, which of course is pretty broad, and my focus is on health care.
And, you know, in regards to health care, I knew Florida was not good. I frankly didn't realize it was quite this bad. I really didn't. You know, in so many areas, they rank 48, you know, state health system, a universal rate, 46 out of 50 states, services support older people, disabilities, 46, developmental disabilities, 49, mental illness, 50. And lacking money, and just last week I talked to Sadaf Knight, your interim co-director at the Florida Policy Institute, and we were talking, frankly, about the very unfair, if you will, tax system here in this state. And with Amendment 5, it would kind of lock it in with that supermajority. And is funding really a huge problem in this state?
Well, our rankings on so many indicators are really shockingly low, and you went through some of the healthcare indicators that we rank very poorly. One of the rankings that may have been included in what Ms. Knight talked about is that we are almost, I believe, dead last in our investments in public services in this state. And that certainly has an impact on the health care delivery system in Florida. We've got lots of people who are uninsured, as you saw from our brief. We're ranked 46 in the number of people uninsured in our state compared to national rankings. And that has huge implications for everyone, not just people who are uninsured. You have more uninsured people. There's more people that are having to use the emergency room. There's more uncompensated care. And those costs get passed on to people who do have coverage. And in the form of higher premiums and increased costs at our healthcare facilities. So we certainly we need more investment. We are we're already very under resourced on healthcare and public services, and we're truly on a collision course with the state's demographics, because we've got a very the fastest growing populations in our state are, you know, people who are elderly and people with disabilities, and they typically have a need for more healthcare services.
And let's put some numbers here. I believe if my statistics here are right, there are 2.8 million uninsured people here in Florida.
And, that's right.
And there are about 400,000 living below the poverty line. And with Medicaid and with the extension of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, why did Governor Scott choose to turn that down?
Well, we are truly shooting ourselves in the foot by not taking that money. And it's really seems to be very ideologically driven, certainly not in any way good public policy for the state. The Florida Policy Institute did a report which showed that if Florida did take the federal funds to expand its Medicaid program, we would in fact save over $500 million a year, because we are already spending lots of state dollars for people who are uninsured in different ways other than through the Medicaid program. And if we took the federal funds, we would be getting a 90% match on the state dollars that we are spending. So it makes no fiscal sense that we're rejecting these funds. And we're talking about, as you said, people who are living under the poverty level. That's, you know, for a single person, about $12,000 a year. And their health care needs don't go away. They're going to have health care needs, and we're all paying for it, even those of us who are insured. These are costs that don't go away. So it the ongoing rejection of expanding our Medicaid program is really hurting the whole state.
And yet we have kind of an upside-down tax system here, while the wealthiest only pay about 2% in their income on taxes, and the poor actually are spending about 13%, and you already have a very high cost of living, and so a kind of the support system is upside-down.
That's absolutely correct. And there really, you know, should be a sign up at our borders that if you are not wealthy, beware, because public services overall in this state are far less resourced than in other states, even other states in the South. It has consequences for all of us.
Well, yeah, we look at mental illness, and we just very recently, you know, with Marjorie Stoneman Douglas and the Parkland terrible shootings, and yet we know that shooter asked for help, and there really wasn't help available. And Florida, the schools had some of the worst provisions for any kind of counseling or mental health, and it's just a matter of personnel and bodies there.
Right, and the mental health services funding, even though we're ranked 50th in the country in investments, we're still putting in millions of dollars, and these dollars could be supplemented with more Medicaid funding. And in fact, our report shows that there would be net savings, because a lot of the folks that were providing services just through state dollars, we could be drawing down federal dollars if we expanded Medicaid. So there's an awful lot of folks, more folks that could be served if we took the federal funds.
And again, we're talking to Ann Swerlich, and she is Health Policy Director with the Florida Policy Institute. And, you know, and we've got important elections coming up. And to me, you know, to me it's almost appalling when we're talking so much about dollars and cents. And not, I don't mean that it's not important, you know, as 61% as opposed to 90% with Medicaid reimbursement, et cetera. You know, that we're talking about people's lives. And that if you really want a sound, good economy and a really good society, then it would seem to me that the health and the well-being and the education and those are the qualities that actually determine the real health and the possibilities for growth in an economy, instead of trying to penny pinch and just, because we're talking people's lives here, and so people either die or they have such a poor quality of life that really they can't really contribute significantly to the state or the country.
Exactly. I mean, this has an impact on our workforce, both currently, because if people, there are many people who have chronic illnesses and disabilities that are working or trying to get back in the workforce, but they need health insurance to support them in that. I mean, health insurance is a vital work support, and so again, this has consequences for the whole state. And then in terms of children, you know, as we know, there's multiple studies and social science research showing how children getting coverage has long-term, very long-term beneficial consequences for them. They're more likely to finish school. They're more likely to earn more money as adults and be healthier as adults.
And, you know, that it happens to be in this state, we've got two very different candidates running for governor. And I know the Florida Policy Institute does not get involved in individual and politics. But there really are, if people look, and I suggest they go to your website and some others to, I must admit that I was not aware that our health care system was quite as bad as it was. And then compare it to the candidates and the people you're thinking of voting for, because in my opinion, they really have real choices this time.
That's right. And I think when people look at these proposals, the devil is really in the details. And so there's a lot of rhetoric out there, you know, whether it's market-based solutions or health savings accounts or greater transparency. There's a lot of buzzwords out there. But you really need to know the details. Is it going to be affordable for people? Particularly for people who are living in poverty, because we can talk about, oh, we'll keep the premiums low, and you know, or people can shop around to find the best price. But you know, if you're living on less than $1,000 a month, you're going to need substantial help to be able to access care at the prices, you know, we're talking about. So I think in looking at these proposals, you have to think about affordability, you know, whether the coverage is going to be adequate. There are more plans that are going to be marketed now that are skimpier. They may not provide coverage for mental health services or maternity care. I mean, the protections that have been in place under the Affordable Care Act are getting eroded right now, so that some of these other plans will be able to be marketed, and people may be enticed to sign up for them because they may, in fact, be cheaper. But the coverage is likely not to be as good, and of course people don't discover that until they get sick and realize that they're not getting what they need.
Yeah, as you just said not too long ago, that there should be a sign, you know, if you need, don't come. And the same thing with, I call some of those junk insurance plans, that technically you might have insurance, just don't need it.
Exactly, right. And of course, Florida had the biggest rate of enrollment through the federal marketplace under the Affordable Care Act, because, you know, those are, that's really good coverage at a very affordable price. And most of the, I mean, I think Florida had about 1.7 million people sign up last time, and most of those people are getting some kind of subsidies, help with the cost of the premiums. So there's a huge need in Florida, and clearly people have voted with their feet by signing up. You hear lots of rhetoric sort of smashing the Affordable Care Act, but I think the proof is in how many Floridians have decided that this makes sense for them, this coverage. It's affordable and it's good coverage.
Well, it seems to me, really, pretty much in this country, in this state, you know, you have a choice. Is health care a right that actually was just a minimal effort you could make available to everybody, an even playing field, so to speak? Or do you want health care to be a for-profit, constantly growing profits industry that has no bounds for riches, but real limitations for illness? And to me, it's almost come to that stage. And to me, we're talking life. We're talking people's lives. And the politics are heavy, and it's really important that people get informed. And so I've had you go through this very quickly, Ann Swerlich. I want to bring you back in more details on things where we can talk more policy and not so much any politics. But is there anything you want to say in conclusion that we didn't cover?
Not that I can think of. I'd be happy to talk with you more at some future time.
Yeah, where we can get into a little more specifics.
Yeah, there's lots of stuff to talk about in the healthcare space.
There sure is. Everything from eligibility, retroactive Medicaid, all of that, which is so...
And there's also, I mean, at some point we may want to talk about the Medicaid Managed Care Program, where we are, over the next 5 years, investing about $90 billion. And that's mainly a for-profit proposition, and so that there's a lot of policy issues there that are really important that, for the most part, are pretty much under the radar screen right now.
Well, I will definitely bring you back soon, and we will discuss that, because that can't stay under the radar.
So, no.
Okay. Ann Swerlich, Florida Policy Institute, thank you so much for giving us this time.
And thank you.
You do take care.
And again, you've got a lot of things to think about, and luckily you have a voice, and you can really use it coming up next Tuesday. Arlene, go ahead.
Get out and vote. That's the important thing. Tell all your friends, family, take them to the polls if necessary, and call your friends and relatives that may be in other states and remind them. This Saturday is the 9th annual Tampa Bay Veg Fest from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. They're at a new location, Perry Harvey Senior Park, 1000 East Harrison Street in downtown Tampa. They have guest speakers featuring Captain Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd, healthy living and eco-friendly exhibitors, delicious vegan food, animal rescues, cooking demos, live music, kids activities, over 100 vendors and 40 food vendors. For information, go to TampaBayVegFest.org, and I did post that on our website. One of the vendors that will be there is Protect Dogs, Vote Yes on 13, and WMNF will also have a booth there. So check it out this Saturday if you get a chance.
You know, I think it was a couple of weeks ago that Duncan Strauss on the Talking with Animals show just had a terrific interview isn't his name Watson, who is the captain of the Sea Wolf. And really, if you want to hear a terrific interview, go back, find it in the archives. It was a wonderful interview, and those are the kind of speakers you're going to get, so it sounds like a fantabulous event. So, okay, people, well, it's a grand moment coming up Tuesday, and be sure and get out to vote.
out. I don't think it's ever been more important that all of us get together and really try and become the nation we really want to see. Okay, well, you have been listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater Community Conscious Radio, and have a great one, people. Just keep it on your dial here all day long. Let's go out with Sweet Honey.
Representation, we want voting representation, we want voting representation, we want voting representation,
we want voting representation,
we want voting representation,
we want
voting representation,
we want
voting representation,
we want
voting representation,
we want
voting representation,
we want
voting representation,
we want
voting representation.
Live from an